Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Really excited to welcome Sean Kerwin to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Sean is the new head coach at Dartmouth College and has run one of the greatest offenses in the history of the game at the University of Virginia, won a couple championships, and really excited to talk lacrosse, talk Dartmouth, and welcome you back to the show. How's it going, Sean?
Jamie, thank you. Thank you for having me again. It's great to be back. Really excited to talk to you about Dartmouth and you know, my story as of recently since the last time we caught up, and just excited to dive in it with you.
Love it. All right, let's start with just talking about what a special group you guys had last year at Virginia. The whole group, of course, but let's talk a little bit about the offense since that was what you're in charge of. I mean, my gosh, what an incredible array of talent, of team players, of weapons. Man, if you could just start talking about those guys and what you did and how you got them to play together and use their skill sets and to make the most efficient offense in Division I last year with a 41 point something percent efficiency, adjusted efficiency, just incredible.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that group up. It's a group that's really, you know, near and dear to my heart. They were tremendous. I would never call them underrated by any means, but you know, when you look at the, you know, looking back on that season and seeing the stats that they were able to produce on the field, it's truly remarkable. And you know, I feel like they didn't necessarily get the credit that they deserved from, you know, just the standpoint of how outstanding some of those numbers are. And so, I mean, like the group was as close-knit and as selfless and as talented of a group that I've ever been around. And you know, they wanted to compete, they wanted to learn, they were incredibly coachable, but they just truly enjoyed their time together. And it was a top-down entire offense approach that, you know, every guy had a voice, every guy, you know, chimed in. And then, you know, we had some tremendous leaders in the front as well, you know, starting with Shell and Sander and Corms at the attack. But then, you know, you think about, you know, adding Thomas McConvey to that group for a year, and, you know, a five-year guy in Jeff Connor. And then Griffin Schutz is kind of that top group of it all. But there's just so many guys that had a piece to that thing. I think the thing that stands out to me the most with that group was just, you know, how the ball moved. I think that, you know, spoke to how, you know, selfless that crew could be. That thing just zipped around and, you know, continued to just put pressure on the defense. And you know, it's cliche to say, but you know, that's a group that truly didn't care who was doing the scoring, and ended up being a lot of Xander and Corms, but you know, those goals were a lot of them were assisted, and you know, that's a mark of a true team. And they ended up breaking, you know, my favorite record that group broke was the all-time assist record in a season for Virginia, you know, and that broke the 2006 record. And that was kind of the last one that, you know, we as an offense, since I had gotten there, really hadn't touched. For us to not only beat it, but, you know, kind of blow it out of the water, was just a mark of such a close knit and together group.
Let's talk about some of those players. Just give us some color on the nuances of what made these guys special, starting with number one, Connor Schellenberger.
Yeah, I mean, Shell is the consummate teammate, professional guy. Just shows up to work every day, continuing to, you know, want to challenge himself to learn and grow. He holds himself to an incredibly, incredibly high standard. He's everything you want in someone that you coach. You know, just has that drive that you almost have to tell him to slow down a little bit with how hard he works and how much he's trying to hone his craft. But you know, talk about a true quarterback understands defenses, understands reads, understands how, you know, what a team's trying to take away, what they're giving them, and really, you know, pours into the prep each week. And I think that's kind of Connor's strength, is how prepared he can be going into games. You saw it this past year, you know, it's no secret he was a little nicked up throughout the year, but he was still producing. I think that all came down to his prep work, him understanding, you know, what he could still do from a physical standpoint, but then also, you know, trying to close the gap from a, just a mental edge and, you know, just having the understanding of where his eyes could go and do it quickly, and allowed him to really quarterback the offense the entire year. And so, you know, again, I think that's just a credit to him and how much he wanted to learn how to be that true quarterback. It's really taken off in his, you know, as he enters his fifth year with that program.
It was fun to see him in the playoffs be back to his old self.
Oh my God, right? It's
because you forgot just how much burst that kid guy has. I mean, like, I remember as a freshman when you guys played Georgetown, and he was just absolutely dominant as a Dodger. And then you watch him against Georgetown in the playoff game this past year, and he's just shooting the shit out of the ball. Like, looks like a Canadian. He looks like he's released like Corms. I mean, he's got the low high pump wind up screenshots. And as a feeder, I mean, as a two-handed guy and a feeder and a quarterback, I mean, this guy is as complete of a player as I think I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, for my money, there was nobody playing better lacrosse than Connor by the end of the year. And that was just a mark again of, you know, him learning how to prep. And, you know, when his body wasn't at its peak, and to be able to learn how to adjust that way. And then when he got healthy, he was able to put it all together. And he was truly, the best player in the country at that moment. Yeah.
How physical is he?
He can be very physical, you know, and I think he likes that contact. I think it kind of, you know, wakes him up a little bit. But at the same time, too, he's so dynamic and so explosive that he doesn't necessarily need that contact either. And so he's, you know, with everything he does, there's just such a healthy balance with how he approaches the game.
The little thing that Kark did on him, where you get a chance to listen to him articulate, you know, why he does what he does. I love the way he described the way he goes at his guy and kind of makes his moves early to kind of get, you know, their hips turned so he can figure out what he wants to do. But man, just like, he's a surgeon in the way he dodges.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And it's always fun. It was fun as a coach, you know, to see a defender try to go out and play him out in space and just kind of, you know, all right, like, you want to go out there with him. That's a tough person to keep up with. Out there in those corners of the field.
Xander Dixon. I mean, this
his
hands are just so silky, and his shooting was just insane. His little low high catch, you know, mid range catch and shoot. I mean, the guy did a lot of things, but talk to us a little bit about his game and what you kind of learned from him.
Yeah. You know, Xander's such a classic case of somebody that just stuck with the process. Obviously, Xander, incredibly talented individual, was tremendous in high school. You know, when he got to us, he was, you know, very skilled, very talented, but, you know, was behind some guys and had to kind of earn his stripes, you know, earning that playing time. And, you know, us, him moving to full time attack, you saw a more confident Xander, one that you saw the year before for sure as a first line midi stalwart of our offense, top six guy. But then it really took off just him being in the in that starting spot. And, you know, what's, I think the ultimate kind of compliment that I can give somebody is Xander's a guy that we wanted to move around a ton. You know, it's similar to what we've done in the past with Shell and with Matt Moore. And so Xander, we'd sneak him out of the box and try to get him different matchups and try to, because he's just such a versatile player, as great as he was off the ball for us. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as he got a short stick matchup, it was, you know, that we had such a huge advantage. So we were doing a lot with him, moving him around more so than anybody else on our roster this past year, as kind of that Swiss Army knife guy for us. And I mean, yeah, you nailed it. His hands are incredible. His wrists, as good as it gets. The way he's able to get that ball off in tight space, change levels, you know, just, you know, shoot with deception. He was as efficient of a shooter as you'll find. You know, between him and Corms, that duo was incredibly, incredibly efficient. It's at times it just seemed like we would just huck that ball into space and one of the two would come up with it. And if the one didn't, the other one would pick up the ground ball and put it in. And so they were just such huge pieces to what we were trying to do. And what I loved is that everybody understood how great they were. And, this, Jamie, myself being an off-ball guy, when you have teammates that understand what they can get away with as feeders take chances and throw to tighter windows because they have the confidence, it really opens up offenses a lot. When you have those guys in there that everybody trusts. You saw it on game day, but you should have seen some of the feeds that these guys would make in practice to these guys, and
it redefines what open is.
And there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And practice was even crazier. Guys would be absolutely blanketed and essentially bear hugged by our scout D, and we'd still be throwing it in there, and they'd still be making plays. And so
did Corms ever catch one behind his back and score one?
No behind the back catches, but
wanted to see. Yeah, that's been a dream of mine for a lot of years.
I've done it in a three-by game. He's back for a 6 year, so maybe he could pull that out as an old dog there.
That's what I want to see when you guys are when they're not you guys anymore. But
yeah, exactly.
I got a chance to coach a couple years ago at Deerfield is Griffin Schatz, man. What an incredible kid. What a great team player. What a motor. I mean, as great as your talent was, he might have been my favorite player in the sense of just all the little things that he did. Talk about a selfless player. Wow.
No question. And Schatzy was somebody that we thought he could have been an attackman for us. We tried it through the fall and even in our preseason scrimmages. And, again, to touch on, his selflessness. It just made more sense for that group to have Xander there and run Griffin out of the midfield and not a single complaint. If anything, there was, a lot of confidence that came out of that move from him. And you're right. I mean, he was the ultimate party starter for us. The guy that we could get long dodging out of the box, pole or short stick, is really somebody you have to make some decisions if you want to slide to or not. And a lot of times teams had to. And Griff was, he's as skilled for a big man as you'll find. His hands are great. How he's able to operate in tight spaces. For him, it was always just making sure he felt as confident as he could going into games. Because when he was confident, he was one of the better players out there, no doubt about it. I think too. When I think back to that, Notre Dame game, and, if Griffin listens to this, I'm sure he'll cringe a little bit, but that take at the end that Entenmann made, that unbelievable save, like that's everything we wanted Griffin to do in that moment. And so that was an opportunity for us to really win that game there. And just was so proud of him to feel that space and be aggressive. And, when I think about that group in particular, from game one, the message was that I always would tell these guys is, in every point of the game, they're going to have an opportunity to make a choice. And as long as they erred on the side of aggression, we were going to be putting ourselves in a great spot. And so it was really about being the aggressor the entire year. And that was just a microcosm of that decision-making. That's what we preached all year. So for us to stray from that in the biggest stage would have been wrong. And so I was just really proud of him to continue to strive to accomplish that messaging. And that's what that group was. If we were the aggressor, we were really, really hard to stop.
How would you characterize or describe your offense? I have an idea, because I've kind of been watching you and studying it, but how would you sort of articulate what you guys were trying to do and how you're, from a principal's perspective and specifics perspective?
Yeah, it's I think the nature of it, it's very simple when you think of the structure. But then from within it, spending more time talking about the freedom within it, spending more time with these guys, explaining the different ways it could be defended and the reads we want to make, as opposed to changing the overall scheme. And so it's, somewhat positionless by nature. But at the same time, there is some structure to it that I felt is needed. And, I think what's cool is that you're able to, introduce more of like a concept based style, but then, you know, as you go along, add the structure that's needed and then you kind of let the two blend together. And so,
and what's your definition of structure?
I think just like start more. It's more, you know, starting spots, different, you know, spots on the field that we want to start and operate from, different spots we want to move to. You know, I think it's a part of it is, you know, positioning ourselves based on what the defense is giving us to put a little bit more strain. You know, it's a lot of, you know, more so kind of where you start than where you finish is kind of where the structure is. And then, you know, from there, there's so many different avenues that you can take it. But it's more about, you know, getting organized early so that spacing is, you know, you can understand that your spacing is great and then moving into spots based on how the defense is playing you. So I guess that's kind of how I would describe structure.
Well, and there's just so many good looks and so little time. And so you just had to sort of, you know, be choosy about them. Like you mentioned, you know, long dodge, but then you've got a couple lefties that can play two-man games and you got X and you got big a little behind and you got, you know, all these different things. So was the structure kind of like how you wanted to start an attack and making sure you're kind of changing it up and getting guys in spots that, you know, allow you to give new looks or different looks or good looks?
Yeah. And I think too, like, as you said, like roles add structure too. Right. So, you know, if someone like Griffin is somebody that we love in space, we loved in space and could, you know, get downhill, like that added structure. Cause we knew he was going to hang up by the box and catch it and go and right. He'd go either way, but that added structure. Whereas, you know, when Thomas and Peyton had it on that lefty wing, we knew what they were going to do, the two of them. So the four guys off the ball, they were able to anticipate. And so you're right. Yeah, you're right. Like, you know, personnel add structure as well to an offense. Mm-hmm.
The passing stat you mentioned is really impressive. And I was blown away by your guys' passing. And I feel like it was something that throughout these championship years, even when you weren't playing as well, you know, early in this championship seasons, I felt like you weren't moving the ball as well as you did later on when you started really turning it on. How do you get a team to move the ball like that? And then, and what is the sort of, you know, why does it sometimes seem to work really well and other times, you know, it dies and sticks a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a mindset, right? It's, you know, it's something that we had to spell out and emphasize. And I made sure I did this from minute one of the past season. That was a goal of ours, is to get that thing moving and making sure we're constantly attacking from different spots on the field. And, you know, it was a lot of then kind of retroactive teaching, you know, using film to explain, hey, like if we just move this here, look at all the space that we have. And just, you know, I think our guys gravitated towards an understanding that that put a lot more pressure and also made their lives easier as opposed to just hanging on to the ball and trying to ISO dodge for one or two seconds too long. And so, you know, I guess it was just as simple as just putting an emphasis on it. And then, you know, it helps to have the group that we had that was just inherently selfless. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of a guy like Thomas McConvey who, you know, had 60 plus goals at Vermont the year before, but, you know, comes in and just has that box background where, you know, it's kind of a staple. And so he was, you know, when you have guys like him and, you know, Shell, who's inherently selfless, and, you know, those guys are, you know, kind of led the charge. Jeff Connor, similar. And then, you know, guys started to realize, hey, this works. This puts a lot more pressure on our opponent. And so it just kind of took off from there and created momentum.
Amazing. All right, let's turn the page and talk a little Dartmouth lacrosse.
Love it. Love it.
So, first of all, who's on your staff?
Yeah, I'm pumped to tell you. So Mikey Herring was the first guy that I hired. Mikey played for me at Virginia, was a sophomore when we took the job, when Lars got hired and Kip and I followed. So he was a part of that entire revamp of the program that for Mikey, you know, finished with his senior year winning that 19 championship. He, you know, I think it's actually on this pod that I did with you after that 19, you know, I've talked about him as well. He is as smart of a lacrosse mind as I've been around as a player. And then, you know, following him and just, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go as far as say mentoring, but staying in touch with him throughout his coaching career as well, and really appreciating kind of the work that he's put in. He was a no-brainer hire for me. First guy I called when I got the job and started thinking about a staff. He will be very helpful on the offensive side of the ball. As, you know, for me, you know, as a first-time head coach, understanding that I don't know what I know yet, right, and what's coming. And so, you know, to have the comfort that I could, you know, potentially leave that offensive huddle and be pulled in different directions as a head coach, knowing that the message will stay the same. And if anything, be just be in fantastic hands with him. We are completely aligned from an offensive standpoint. And so I'm really excited. And he's as hard of a worker and just been blown away by everything so far with him, and already feeling pretty high about him. But he's great. And then defensively hired Matt Witcher, who played at York College, spent the last 5 years coaching at his alma mater at York. They've had one of the best defenses in Division III over the last 5 years. Matt's somebody that I've heard about over the years, is kind of somebody that's that next guy to make that jump from Division III to Division I. And we're just very lucky to have an opportunity to add him on staff. I think his potential is through the roof. He's incredibly detail oriented. He's an incredible teacher. Like, you know, you talk to him about, you know, anything from approaching on ball to pick play, the way he thinks about it and the way he can, you know, describe it to you is very digestible. It's incredibly insightful. It all makes sense. Everything that he says, there's a purpose to it. And so I'm really excited for him to be working with our defenders. He's a defensive middy in Premier Lacrosse League. And what I love about it too, is he's kind of self-made. You know, he was a do-it-all guy at York, started as an O-middy that ended up just being somebody that never left the field for him. And to make it in the pros, he really had to commit to being a D-middy. And he's, you know, it's for my money, he's one of the best ones in the league.
No doubt. And he really scores goals.
Yeah, he does. He sure certainly does. And if he's shooting and he doesn't score, I make sure he hears it from me, as far as maybe you should get it down to those attackmen and let them do their job. But he's great. He's awesome. I love working with him and Mikey. I think those guys are truly just budding stars in this profession. And I'm very grateful to have them with me here as we try to, right the ship here and take some steps forward. And my third assistant, just hired, his name's Kyle Helfrich. Kyle played at Tufts, was an All-American Faceoff guy at Tufts. In the last 2 years has been at Catholic University, coaching for another Tufts alum, John Sachs. And so Kyle's coming over as well to work with our goalies and our faceoff guys. And so, it's interesting. I'm only 33, but it's a young staff. I am certainly the old head. So it's a little bit of a different mindset for me as well. But it's been a lot of fun. These guys have been tireless workers, constantly asking what more they can do. And so really, really excited about getting to work with them.
Amazing. All right. So, you take this job and there's just so much to do. How do you, as a new head coach, what can you give us a little, I know there's like endless things that you've done, but how did you kind of prioritize what was you had to do in taking the job? Like what were the main big picture things that you had to do that you really put your main focus into this summer?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because you never know until you're in it. Right. So, I felt, as prepared as I ever have in my life to make this jump. I really felt like it was the perfect kind of, meeting point of my prep and then also opportunity. And so, for me, I went into it feeling confident and prepared, and then, you sign that dotted line and your phone immediately becomes a war zone. which is great. A lot of texts of support, a lot of, coaches reaching out to connect, all those things. I think it was really important for me to take a step back and really prioritize what was important in the current moment, because there's always something to be done, right? And there's always another thing that comes up. And so it was, I think the smartest thing that I did was understand, like, all right, like what needs to be done now, what can wait, you know, where do we have time, where do we not have time? And so, you know, it really boiled down to, you know, trying to get a hold of the guys on the team. So individual conversations with everybody on the roster, that was kind of a summer long approach, knowing that I can kind of check that off as, you know, I'm in the car driving to different events, things like that. And so, you know, but like having that be known as this is something that needs to happen and communicating that with the team, finding a staff. Cause again, you know, I can only be one place at one time. And so, you know, to be able to have Dartmouth be in multiple places at once was going to be really helpful as well. And then, you know, the third one was, you know, recruiting. You know, that was the what was going on right in the moment. And we still had 2024 spots to fill. And so, you know, that was the immediate need for the program. You know, and then you throw in, you know, wrapping my head around a schedule and contacting coaches, seeing what's already been set and then what needed to be added to fill in dates. But those were the things that needed to, in my opinion, needed to be done right away. And so it was just trying to take that day by day. And, you know, it's not going to lie in the fact that like things could and have gotten a little overwhelming, but, you know, for me, it was just, you know, the best thing I did was take a step back and realize, okay, this can be done tomorrow. Like this, all this does not need to be done today. You know, this is a long approach, a long-term process, and not get too caught up with what seems like a never-ending to-do list and just, you know, take it day by day and checking off box by box.
And then all the not as fun stuff, like finding a place to live, moving.
Yeah, right. You'd think that would be one of the first things. Yeah, but that actually, you know, probably should have been a little bit higher.
I know.
But it all worked out. And, you know, getting settled up in Hanover was kind of on the back burner, and knowing that, like, hey, there was no rush because our summers are stockpiled with events and different places we can be. And, you know, and then, you know, I think one of the smartest things that I did was when I hired Coach Herring, and he was the first one that I hired, Mikey, was really assigning him to learning everything about the 2025 class. And having myself more so hone in on the 24s to wrap up that class. So instead of having both of us trying to do both, and then Matt came on a couple weeks later. So then he was really helpful to kind of close the gap with the 25s, but, you know, essentially saying like, hey, I'll handle wrapping up our 24 class. You guys handle, you know, really the initial kind of evals of the 25s, and I can always play catch up with film and the back end of the summer. And that's really helpful. I got nervous with the idea of trying to juggle both with everybody trying to juggle it that we would miss, you know, and it's like trying to do too much is counterintuitive. So that really helped, you know, really happy with kind of how the final stamp we put on this 24 class. And then we still feel very prepared, you know, as far as our evaluations are concerned for the 25s.
Nice. I do think that sometimes when you try to do too much in recruiting, it really hurts you because the sample size is already problematic. You just don't see enough. And then trying to see everybody, you know, I remember people being like, yeah, I saw every team. Well, there's just no way you know very many because my model was at Denver, I was like, I knew I wasn't getting certain kids. So I didn't even, you know, bother. I was like West, Colorado, Midwest, Canada, New England prep schools. And I would just make sure I followed those teams around so I could see, you know, 6 or 8 evaluations of games on those guys instead of trying to see a half or two of like everybody. But what's your take for how you guys were able to try to, you know, see all the best players, but really get good evaluations on players, because it's almost more important to have the depth than just the huge list.
Yeah. And I think this year is so unique too, because we're new and we don't, you know, again, we're still learning about, you know, this school and kind of where our niches can fall. And so it's, you know, so you almost have to overdo it a little bit, you know, now. I think as we go along here, year in, year out, that'll become a little bit more efficient of a process. Mm-hmm. But right now it's just log in the the man hours of both on the field, but then now just kind of circling back and diving into the film, which again, I think if you think back to the COVID time, like, you know, it's an absolute silver lining that came out of it is that, you know, we got very, very used to, you know, using film evaluation. That was the only thing we could for that year. And then realizing that, you know, that group showed up as first years this past year and realizing like, okay, those film evaluations, they actually held true. Like these are the guys that we thought we were recruiting and they show up on, you know, on your doorstep and you don't feel like you were too far off with those evaluations. And so that just only strengthened the feeling that, hey, you can use film to really supplement and still get those true evaluations. And it's always great to see somebody live, but, you know, knowing that you don't have to all the time. So again, I think just learning from the, you know, that weird COVID era.
Yeah, that's interesting. Who were your, so the kids that you recruited during the COVID summer of 2020 were freshmen this past year. And who was in the class again?
So that's like Truett Sunderland played a little bit for us, number three at Virginia. Joey Terenzi was in that class at Virginia. Ryan Colsey, Kyle Morse, goalie, John Schroeder, a defenseman. You know, these guys are fantastic lacrosse players. And then, you know, it's a pretty talented group of first years here, you know, with, you know, Emmett Paradine being the kind of the forefront of it all. He, you know, was Ivy League Rookie of the Year this past year. And so I think it's, and again, he was evaluated through film. So, you know, and that we're very thankful that he landed here in Hanover.
As you, you know, your team's going to be, you're going to have your first meeting here in the next few weeks. I guess you guys start in September, probably, right? A little bit later than some, right? Something like
that. Yeah, we're trimesters. So we don't start classes till September 11th, which, you know, again, I think I'm sure in a couple of years from now, you'll ask me, I'll be chomping at the bit to get going. But for me, it's kind of nice. You know, it's, you know, gives us time to move up here, gives us time to get organized. And so that when it does come, we can really hit the ground running. To think that I think this is, you know, freshman move-in week from where I was, you know, so I think that we would already be starting is, you know, a little daunting. And so just thankful for the academic calendar that we have. And then, you know, what's also really cool is that, you know, we had our entire, you know, rising junior class here all summer. Dartmouth does a one term summer program called, you know, it allows, you know, you finish your sophomore year and then you stay on campus for that summer and take classes and hang out and enjoy the Upper Valley in the summer, which is a beautiful time to be up here. And so it was cool for me to, you know, the kind of one-off times where I'd be up here to be able to meet guys and like get some face-to-face time. And so that was really important as well.
So when you meet with the team, and what's the message? What are you going to kind of present to them about your vision and, you know, your standards and what you believe this program can be?
Yeah. I appreciate you asking that. I think it's an ever growing process as far as like what that final message would be. But the biggest thing that I'm going to ask these guys is as simple as it can be, is that they care, right? Like they care about the school, this community, they care about this program. You know, they care about their teammates. They care about their craft, right? You know, they're here to play lacrosse. You know, I want them to care about, you know, improvement and they're honing in their skills and just coming to work every day to show that they care about, you know, what they're trying to do as a lacrosse player, as an individual, as well. And so, you know, when you care about something, you know, you're going to put your whole effort into it, right? Like I can confidently tell you that I care about this sport with my whole heart. And so every day I pour my heart and soul into this profession because I truly care about it. And so that'll be the overall message, you know, within that, you know, it's, you know, I'm a big believer and we got to have some courage and resiliency, right? You know, it's, this is, when you look at this program historically, you know, these are facts. It just hasn't been that successful. And so, you know, it took courage to take this job. It's going to take courage for guys to, you know, to hold each other to a higher standard, to really try to close the gap in this league. You know, it's going to take courage to speak up and make some changes and change the ways things maybe have done in the last, you know, several years. And, You know, and then we also have certainly have to be resilient, right? There's no doubt that we're going to take our fair share of licks. We're absolutely going to celebrate our wins, but we also got to be ready for those valleys in the grand scheme of this process. And so, we got to make sure we're ready to get back up when we get knocked down. And so, resiliency to me it screams toughness, right? And so instead of saying, hey, we got to be tough, toughness will come. In order to be resilient, you have to be tough. But, for me, it's really, handling that adversity that's certainly going to come here. And then from there, it's, we got to make sure that we, like I was saying with my summer, right? Like accomplishing what needs to be accomplished in the moment, right? And not worry about the down the road issues or problems or just even just the down the road schedule, right? Because it can get daunting when you think about this task. And so, we got to be, have that action driven mindset where it's like, what are the things that we can do today to be better? And at the end of the day too, we want to make sure we're having fun, right? And we want to be enthusiastic with everything that we're doing. I'm a huge believer. This is a Coach Daly-ism through and through. The lacrosse needs to be the best 2 hours of our day. And if it's not, that's on the job of the coaches to make sure that it is. And it's on the players to make sure they have the courage to come speak up if it's not. And so we want to make sure we're having fun. This is an absolutely fun sport. That's why one of the main reasons why I fell in love with it. It's the only sport that I was a part of where practice was almost as fun as games. I love coming to practice every day. And so we want to make sure that reverberates through the program. And, we want to be as enthusiastic as we can with everything that we're doing. And so those will be like the key tenets, those translate both on and off the field. From there, we'll have our standards of what we expect on the field. But for me, if you're going to start a program and revamp a culture, you got to make sure that everything that you're preaching is translatable through from both on and off the field.
I love it. The love of being there the best 2 hours of the day is one of the most underrated and important concepts for any of us to remember. And because I think people will be more resilient and tougher and care more about things they love, more so than just being forced into that. Like if you love something, you'll sacrifice for it.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And again, I think that's the beauty of the sport. Like I played football in high school and maybe I have a different opinion than others, but I hated football practice. Football games were some of the best things I've ever been a part of. Some of my favorite high school memories were, a Friday night game or something like that. But practice was miserable. And maybe because I was an offensive lineman and, it's just another sled or another pad that I had to hit and things like that. But like, man, it's just was so different. I would always look forward to lacrosse season because every day I could go out with a stick in my hands and have fun doing it with my best friends. And so that's, always something that I've tried to bring with me anywhere that I've been.
I love it. Well, obviously you mentioned a second ago that, it's encouraged to take this job because they haven't been successful. Dartmouth hasn't been traditionally successful, but obviously you would have taken the job. You would not have taken the job if you didn't think you could be successful. Can you share with us why you're so excited about this and why you think you can win? And so that people can also understand that too.
Absolutely. I've been on record, and shared this. It really comes down to two things, right? It's one was incredibly, incredibly easy to check off. And that when I thought about becoming a head coach in that day, I'm sure all assistant coaches, at some point they're thinking of that day where they make that jump and what that program looks like. What is a job that would, allow you to take that jump? And a little side note before I dive into that is like, I had the best assistant coach job in the world. Like I was living my dream every day. I was around some of the most talented lacrosse players I've ever been around. They were incredibly hardworking, incredibly selfless. I absolutely love that place and still do. It'll always be near and dear to my heart. Just had a tremendous, so much fun in my 7 years. Through ups and downs, it was still fun. And so every day I was living out a dream of mine to be a coordinator in the ACC. And so it was going to take a lot to make that jump. The first one, which was pretty non-negotiable for me, if I were going to leave a place like Charlottesville, the job I would take needed to be at a high academic institution. That to me was important. That's who I was as a student athlete. It's who I was in the recruiting process. That's where I started. I played collegiately at Tufts. you know, and then coached at Tufts, coached at Brown, and then Virginia, right? Those are all high academic institutions. You know, I've always felt that I relate to that student athlete the best. And so not to say that I can't, you know, relate to somebody that isn't in that wheelhouse, but at the same time, it just, for me, being a first-time head coach, it was all about setting the program up that I was going to take over for success. And so, you know, that was, you know, the number one box that needed to be checked. And obviously Dartmouth checks that in spades. And you're talking about one of the best institutions in the world, from an undergrad standpoint. And, you know, it's, you know, in such an incredible league in our sport, you know, it's the Ivy League is powerful throughout college athletics. But, you know, what's so unique about lacrosse is that, you know, if you are, you know, trending towards the top of the Ivy League, you're also trending towards the top of the national rankings. They go hand in hand, right? You know, it's, you know, and you're seeing teams make Final Fours and win national championships from this league. And so, it's so unique to our sport in a lot of ways that, you know, this league is so nationally competitive year in, year out. So that was an easy box to check. The second one was going to be, I knew it was going to be one that I needed to flush out. And so what's cool is that I always tell the story of, you know, through the quick interview process that happened, you know, every call, every Zoom, every conversation I had went, you know, probably twice as long, because, you know, a normal process, you get asked a bunch of questions and then there's 10 minutes for you to ask questions about, you know, what's on your mind as a candidate. And those 10 minutes turned into hour long conversations because I had a lot of questions. And so, you know, I wanted to make sure that that second box that needed to be checked for me is I needed to feel that there was a roadmap to success. And that one that, you know, when you stripped it down to its core, it, you know, success was up to the coaching staff. So myself and my staff, the players in the locker room and the culture that we were trying to build. And if you could say that, hey, success is going to be driven by these three things, and really they're going to be at the forefront of why you're successful or not, like that's a program that's set up for success. And again, you got to, you know, do your jobs both as coaches and players. But at the same time, there was nothing, I want to make sure there's nothing that we couldn't control that necessarily was going to hold us back from success. And so there was a lot of conversations that needed to be had. And what I found quickly was that there's this unique and strong alignment here at Dartmouth that's new. And so, you know, when I think about, you know, from the top down, we just got a new president of the school, Sion Bylock. She is, just tremendous, tremendous person. Her kind of claim to fame, kind of what she is most known for, is she wrote a book all about choking under pressure and why human beings choke under pressure and what comes into, you know, that process. And, you know, she was a college athlete herself, soccer and actually club lacrosse out in California. So she has an athletics background and understands how important athletics can be to a school. And so here you have a, you know, an Ivy League president that has an athletics background and understands the value of it, which is rare. And, you know, and then you throw in our new athletic director, Mike Harity, who is just finished his first year on the job. And he came from Army and before that was at Notre Dame. What I love about Mike is that, you know, his previous two jobs, both at Army and Notre Dame, he was the sports administrator for men's lacrosse at both places. So not only does he understand how very successful athletic departments work, he also understands, you know, lacrosse and how, you know, valuable that sport can be to an athletics department. And so, you know, here you have this alignment from, you know, the president down to the athletic director, down to me as a coach, where, you know, we all want Dartmouth athletics to really take a huge step forward, and we'll do whatever it takes to make sure we're accomplishing that, or at least setting ourselves up for the opportunity to accomplish that.
So that sounds amazing. And hopefully it's manifesting itself in from a recruiting perspective, because you said it yourself, it's a world-class institution. It's an incredible part of the world. Dartmouth is a first choice for a ton of people and an incredible choice for anybody, academically speaking. Question is, from a recruiting perspective, can you get kids in that you want, and can you get the numbers? Maybe more importantly, the numbers, given the fact that it's hard to get it right, in the NFL draft, when you've got way more information, resources, and older athletes, it's harder to get it right in college athletics. And so therefore having more draft picks always helps. You feeling good about that?
Yeah. What I will tell you is that that was absolutely on my mind as well. And, you know, again, I think, you know, be sitting here with a D on my chest can tell you that I'm very confident that we're set up for success and everything that we need to do here. And so, yeah. You know, I'm really excited about the overall approach that the school has, and the vision that we have as an entire community, you know, here at Dartmouth. It's there's a lot of momentum, and you can feel it. You can feel it in the hallways here. You can feel it from the guys on the team. You can feel it from the top down. And so it's just exciting. And we've been really enjoying that momentum, and excited for the future.
People love Dartmouth. Anybody who goes to Dartmouth loves Dartmouth. And to be able to turn Dartmouth into a lacrosse school is going to be incredible. You'll have guaranteed tons of support, tons of excitement in the school spirit. I mean, there's just amazing school spirit at Dartmouth. You know, I've witnessed it with lots of friends that have gone there.
It's no secret either. You get up here and you're like, okay, this, and now it makes sense. You know, like you spend just even a little bit of time up here and you realize why alums are so, you know, glued to this place and had such a great experience as an undergrad. It's truly special. You know, there are some unique things that Dartmouth can provide that are just different than the rest of the league. And, you know, in such positive ways, you know, and then again, you throw in the beauty of just the upper valley up here. You know, anybody that has any, you know, enjoyment of nature and the outdoors, it's, you know, it's, the place is just gorgeous. It's so immediately I could feel why, you know, exactly what you're describing. It's no secret. It really is. You just got to get up here and see it for yourself. And it's truly remarkable.
Amazing. All right, let's talk a little bit about your approach to developing this team, both off the field from a culture perspective, which I know you kind of touched on, so you don't have to dive into it and repeat yourself if that's kind of what the message is, but also specifically like from developing the players and getting them to play lacrosse the way you want them to, and really just kind of the more so the big picture and the theory behind how you like to develop players.
Yeah, no, it's you know, we're in a an interesting phase, and again, it's, you know, this year will be so different than future years, and the fact that like we have to balance as a staff, and it's conversations we have constantly of, you know, we have to not only instruct and develop and teach, but we also have to evaluate. You know, and I'm a huge believer in that you shouldn't fix things that aren't broken. And so learning is a huge part of this job for us as a staff, learning about what's been done before, about what's worked and what hasn't, why hasn't something worked? You know, is that, you know, something that we can change immediately, or is that something that's going to, you know, need to be unpacked a little bit? You know, who's on our team? Like what is our skill set today? You know, and those are all things that we need to learn before we start really getting our hands on these guys and helping them develop. You know, cause you know, part of it is, yes, this is a, you know, multi-year, you know, approach as we think long-term, but in the short term too, we want to set ourselves up for success as quickly as we can. And so part of that as well is like learning what we have and then, okay, how can we improve and build off of what we already have in front of us? And so it's going to be an interesting fall because it's going to be that kind of blend, right? And so it's, you know, we'll probably start the fall a little bit more on the evaluative side, mm-hmm. and then slowly and surely, and then, you know, finish with kind of like team improvement and teaching, but then finish the fall with more of that individual approach and individual teaching as the, you know, our time with the guys shrinks a little bit. And so what is nice is that, you know, we do have time. You know, it's, you know, there are some Ivy League restrictions as far as how much you can practice, but, you know, I'm telling you right now, it's not too crazy. Don't feel like we're hindered by any means. Still feel like we have plenty of time to do all of this, but it's just going to be different. you know, and so we're excited to use drills and to, you know, that we feel like are best representations of all different things you can evaluate, but then also really making sure that we are, you know, when think about the individual development of things, you know, we want to develop free thinkers, we want to develop decision makers, you know, so a lot of our individual development and team development will be for based on, you know, putting these guys in situations to make decisions, right? And then cleaning up the fundamentals as we go and understanding what, you know, what you can get away with, what you can't, and then how to sharpen that. But, you know, by the end of the fall, I'm hopeful to be able to report to you back and say like, hey, we've improved our decision-making. We've improved kind of our free thinking and hopefully our aggressiveness at the same time. Right. And, you know, cause you know, tempo is such an important part of this game and rhythm and flow. And we want to be the aggressor anytime we step on the field.
When you talk about decision-making, can you give us it's a wide array of topics, but when you're going to coach it and work on it, you know, can you give us some examples of how you would say, okay, here's some decision-making we want to work on. Here are some drills or situations that we will design with that in mind.
Yeah. You know, I think it's, you know, decision-making is such an interesting skill to work on. Cause it's such a, like you were saying, such a vague and vast topic, right? So a lot of it is, to me, I've learned through my years is putting guys in situations that highlight making decisions often. So like a lot less, you won't see us do too much. We'll do enough that we need to, but you're not going to see us do too much like 10v10 scrimmaging, right? You're going to see us shrink the game, shrink the field, so that guys are put in different pieces of situations where they're able to get, you know, make 10 decisions when in a normal game, they'd only make the same decision once. Right. And so we want to try to like expose our guys to a lot of opportunities to make decisions, and then using, you know, film or just maybe in the moment, just, you know, trying to, you know, get these guys to learn about the decisions that they made and, you know, highlight great decisions and correct bad ones and just continue to expose them to those different, you know, aspects of this game. So it's a lot of shrinking, you know, as you and I have talked about this in the past, I'm sure, right? Like shrinking the field, you know, putting an emphasis more on the amount of opportunities they get and then teaching from there.
Right.
And
again, scaling your decision-making opportunities through smaller numbers.
And exposure, right? Exposure to more opportunities to do that. And again, I think it'll be, you know, drills that we like that will probably allow, you know, random decisions to be made throughout, right? So instead of having too much structure on a drill, you know, there will be times where we need to really hone in on a specific decision to be made, but then also just allowing these guys to go play in small scale situations. And, you know, whether it's, you know, 3v3s, 4v4s, or odd man stuff, just depending on what we want to focus on, you know, just, you know, something that can be repeated often. So that they're leaving, you know, a 7-8 minute period with a lot of exposure.
What kind of constraints do you utilize? You mentioned shrinking, so that would be smaller numbers. There's obvious ones that everybody uses, uneven versus all even, stuff like that. But are there various constraints that you utilize with time or space or goal sizes that you feel like create different sort of challenges that create then different adaptations?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can, I always am like tweaking little things as far as like, you know, maybe a direction, like, hey, the ball can move just this direction, or hey, this is the only way you can support as a defense, and just kind of like putting, you know, shackles on different aspects of the game that could maybe foster some more specific looks that we're looking for. But at the same time too, like this game is so fluid that, you know, some of the times you're better served just letting it happen organically. Right. And just more of just, you know, trying to find something that's a little bit more high rep, type of drill to then just kind of let the chips fall as they may. But, you know, as far as, you know, there's some fun things that we can do as far as just like limiting taking a decision off the table. right? And almost eliminating one decision you can make to then maybe highlight a second or third one a little bit more.
Like what? What would be an example of that?
You could have a 3v3 drill where that ball has to go, like you have to throw the ball forward, right? Like you're never going to be able to roll away and throw back, and just understanding that. And, whether that's I think too about like two man game, if you're going to add a third guy to that mix sometimes, instead of trying to just throw back to the guy that set that pick for you, understanding, hey, like you can let that next guy make that read.
Yeah.
And understanding the value in letting the next guy make that read is something that we try to emphasize.
Interesting. You mentioned the word fundamentals earlier. What are some of the fundamentals? When you think of the word fundamentals, what comes to mind?
See, this is probably an inch. Like I guess I'm a little different in that, like, I'm not like somebody that's like, oh, you got to shoot the ball overhand every time you do it, or, the stick's got to be this specific position or anything like that. It's just more, again, like my idea of fundamentals are, you got to be able to pass and catch, got to be able to pick up ground balls. How you do it is how you've done it your whole life. And if we need to change your form, it's because we feel like it's hindering you as a lacrosse player, like not because we think that that's the best way to do it. Right. And so, when I think about like, shooting, that's where it can be a little taboo. Like if you're someone that knows how to put the ball in the net, but you're shooting everything from your hip and lower, like I'd be doing you a disservice trying to get you to change. Cause I'm strictly a overhand shooting type of mindset. So my fundamentals are more like, as long as it works, like I don't care how it looks, but it's just taking the time to understand that we need to be able to practice these things. And then, as we develop schemes and offenses, I also believe wholeheartedly that your fundamentals should be drilled within your schemes. Right. And so like, if this is if you think about maybe not like the home run looks, but you think about like the Big Little we would run at Virginia, understanding how that ball needs to move from your outlets, like you can, we would set up stick work drills of how to keep the ball alive within our offense. And so we would eliminate the crease and just work. Okay. Like, hey, we're going to drive up right-handed. We're going to work on just passing the ball around the horn off of a dodge and understanding like, hey, when you catch this ball, you need to be loaded, and then you need to be able to be loaded, but also listen if you have that one more opportunity, and just drilling those fundamentals within the schemes. I think, again, I don't can't speak to anyone else, but that's something that we've done everywhere that I've been, of just, taking our schemes and making sure that the stick work and shooting aligns with the schemes that we're running.
I love it. One of the things you mentioned earlier was being the aggressor. One of the things I kind of think as a fundamental is both applying pressure and handling pressure. Maybe one of the most important parts of the entire game, and especially in a program that's new, like to be able to just go actually get after it, get after people, but to handle it. You can't win games if you can't either apply pressure to get the ball back at the end of the game or handle the pressure that's going to be applied to you. And it's sort of the definition of poise in winning teams when you can handle that pressure. How do you sort of view that, and how will you kind of work on that this as you take over this program?
Yeah. I mean, they go hand in hand, right? Like if we're going to say, hey, like our goal is to be the aggressor, then also in practice every day, both teams are going to be trying to apply it. So both teams need to handle it as well. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. Like, and I think that's been the kind of a secret weapon for us in the last 7 years at Virginia, is that, we've always been an aggressive minded team. And so that, you've seen that poise develop from, that comes from the practice field as much as it does in the experience in the games. And so, when you have those inner squad competitions, if everybody in the program is, erroring on the side of aggression, then, at some point someone's going to have to handle that pressure as well. Right. And so you're able to, again, that exposure to different events and understanding how to handle it and making the right decisions when it does come, it's all tied together. Right. And so you're right. It's like a cool silver lining of like, okay, if you want to practice and practice what you preach, and then on game day, you want to be aggressive, well, you better be doing that every day. And if you're doing that, at some point, someone's going to have to handle it as well. And so it's a cool way to kind of feed into itself.
I know sometimes if you don't apply that pressure to yourself, you can feel really good about how good you're getting until somebody pressures you and punches you in the face.
No doubt. No doubt. And, you know, again, I'll give credit where credit's due. I think that's one of the things that Duke's been able to do to Virginia the last couple of years is you know, especially against our offense, is we did not do a great job of handling their pressure at times. And, you know, if I think the second game that we played them this past year is probably the ultimate example. It was the first half. That was as foreign of a team as I was watching when I think about that offensive group. They just were unrecognizable because they weren't handling pressure. And then, you know, dug ourselves a huge hole and then flipped the switch at halftime. And you saw a complete change and we were becoming the aggressor. And all of a sudden we were creating our own luck and getting a couple bounces. And, you know, and that's the other thing too, when you are aggressive, there's no secret that creates some luck for you. And all of a sudden it does seem like the more aggressive team gets some of the luckier bounces out in this game, which is a part of it, right? It's a small rubber ball that can do some crazy things sometimes. And, you know, and so when you have that aggressive mindset, you're putting yourselves in more positions to get a little lucky out there.
No doubt. When I was an assistant at Yale, that was probably the main thing I took away from working for Mike Waldvogel, was just how much he pressured the crap out of the offense every single day. I mean, whether it was double teaming every pick, you know, every day 4-on-4 double team, keep it in the box every day. You know, 6-on-5 full pressure on defense, where the defense was playing as if it was man to man and they were playing, you know, what he called blue pressure, which was pressuring the adjacent in the direction the ball was going and being able to, you know, just put those guys on their heels. And we didn't really play defense that way. Actually, we played more of a, you know, kind of a classic packed in, you know, help and recover defense, but man, it was amazing. And I feel like anytime that I have gotten away from that, I've really regretted it, because I feel like it really hurt both sides of the ball.
No question. Yeah. And I actually think it may hurt, you know, if your defense isn't aggressive, it probably hurts your offense more than it hurts your defense, right? Because then it's a stark difference when you go against a team that's pressuring.
And it's like, it's getting punched in the face and you're just not used to being punched in the face. Yeah. You know?
No question.
Let's finish this up a little bit with recruiting. So September 1 is coming up. And you can give us some idea of what you look for. And I know it's going to be different, and I know there's position within positions, but maybe just kind of run through some positions and say, okay, you know, this is what we look for out of attackmen, and maybe talk about the positions within positions.
Yeah, you know, I think the overarching approach of any position that we're looking for, and it's one of the harder things to evaluate, but, you know, feel pretty confident, something that we've been, you know, so far able to navigate and learn enough about to feel confident with these evaluations is, you know, we put a huge emphasis on lacrosse IQ. I think it's, you know, we consider ourselves pretty good coaches, but it's really nice to have a guy that sees the game in a way and can process things at a faster rate than somebody that's maybe a little bit more raw of an athlete. And so we put a huge emphasis on that in every position. And so, you know, when I think about attackmen in high school that translate into college, you know, again, for us, you know, it'll always be, to me, I'm always going to try to put my top three offensive players on attack. And, you know, if they, for whatever reason, can't grasp the attack position, that's when they get moved to midfield. But, you know, you've seen it in the years that I was at Virginia, you know, those attackmen, you know, for all intents and purposes, those were our top three guys. And so just to keep those guys on the field. So it doesn't really, to me, it doesn't matter as much of where you play in high school, but it's more about like how you're able to handle every phase of the offense. Are you somebody that can understand spacing and odd man rushes and decision-making in transition? Are you somebody that can, you know, take space and more importantly, just like control the flow of a game? You know, we want to play as fast as we possibly can here at Dartmouth while still giving ourselves the best chance to win a game. And so, you know, where that falls as far as like tempo statistics, we might not be the fastest team as far as those statistics, but we're going to play fast and then, you know, trust the attackmen that are out in the field to control the game and understand how much defense do we just play? What's the situation calling for? And trying to get these guys to set up the team for the best success. They're the ones offensively that are out there the whole time. And so that takes a lot of lacrosse IQ. That is can be taught, but at the same time, it's really helpful when you know, there's not as big of a gap of teaching there. And that translates to, you know, when you think defensively, you know, it's always interesting, like the guys that, you know, you may fall in love with on the recruiting trail versus the guys. I know this is a conversation you've had with Coach Tiffany in the past too, of like, you know, the guys that end up playing for you are usually the ones that are smartest and can understand your slide schemes and can understand team defense. And, you know, and because at the end of the day, like, you know, there's some fantastic one-on-one defenders, but, you know, everybody has their off day. Everyone can get beat from time to time. And it's really about what's behind you and making sure you're organized and aggressive there. And so, again, putting that emphasis on people that understand spacing, understand how to, you know, how to play team defense, that's all across IQ. And so we put a huge emphasis on that. And so that's a tricky thing to evaluate, but you got to do your homework.
That's what I was going to ask. How do you evaluate that? What
it's a combo, right? You can see things, right? There's definitely some plays. And if guys are making consistently smart plays, you know, it's, you can get a couple things here or there on field evaluations. That's where film really helps too. Cause you can really start to like watch and focus and, you know, not be distracted by, you know, if you're taking a note with your head down, like you can go rewind, right? And so you can go see, okay, he made this decision. Why did he make this decision? Was this lucky or is this like, did he understand? Was he, were his eyes up before that ball even got to his stick? Or he was, you know, you can just tell that this is somebody that was scanning the field well before that ball even arrived, right? And so, you know, there are little things there that we can pick up. But then also it's conversations, you know, with their, you know, club coaches, high school coaches, understanding who these guys are and how they tick and, you know, just kind of getting that feedback, as well from people that they're close with. You know, it's always interesting to know if somebody's, you know, had a, you know, a father that played and coached and things like that, like sons of coaches tend to, you know, you're talking to one, you know, myself grew up around the game and, you know, was able to learn from my dad, but then just kind of gravitated towards any coach that I, you know, played for, you know, was, you know, really connected with. And so, you know, that's an opportunity to learn about that as well. And that's all just doing your homework. And so, but that's something that we put a huge emphasis on here. You know, we want to try to be as smart of a team as we can. You know, we want guys to understand because we're going to ask them to really make decisions and think, you know, I'd like to say that, you know, the game days are some of my easier days as a coach because I'm putting a lot of trust in the players on the field, you know, and making adjustments accordingly. But at the end of the day, like hopefully our work's been done already and our guys are prepared so they can go out and make the decisions themselves.
Are there prototypical sort of athletes you like, or do you like to have a mix? How do you sort of look at that?
I mean, I'm, you know, you're talking to somebody that, you know, I'm the epitome of, you know, lacrosse players coming in all shapes and sizes. You know, I had a successful career as a dumpy crease attackman that couldn't, you know, could barely move, but just relied on teammates and my lacrosse IQ to be successful. And so, you know, this sport is one of the best parts about it, right? It's like, you know, we talked about how it's so much fun to practice, but it's also like, there are so many different ways to be successful on a lacrosse field. And so, there isn't a prototypical guy that we, you know, gravitate towards necessarily as far as from an athletic standpoint. You know, it's always nice to put a premium on athleticism, but two, there's just understanding there's so many different ways for that to be approached. And, you know, there's so many different benefits to different, you know, types of athletes, types of lacrosse players that, you know, it's our job to take those types of guys and build schemes that put them in to be successful. And, you know, we're almost better served taking an array and being versatile that way, as opposed to having a kind of a cookie cutter mold that we gravitate towards.
Yeah, totally. How about goalies?
Yeah, it's a position I'm still, you know, I have had the luxury of having a Kip down at Virginia, kind of the one of the better evaluators that I've been around in that position. And, you know, just, you know, been able to steal some concepts with him from there. For me, personally, as an offensive guy, right, I like a goalie that you feel, right? Like, and so that can be, you can take this in so many different ways, right? But like, you know, there are some goalies out there that are fantastic, but they just kind of blend into defenses, right? And they're just a part of the defense. Like I always gravitate towards the goalies that like you really have to prep for. And so that can mean that a goalie is a little bit more unorthodox, right? That can mean that this is a goalie that you have to, like, there's always something to be said for, you know, again, in a scouting report, like, if this is something that's a little unique to, you know, what you're used to getting ready for an opponent, like, those are the types of goalies that I tend to, like, weirdly gravitate towards. So they might not be the prettiest, but, you know, there's something to be said for being different. You know, I think, and you and I have spoke about this before, like, and you're seeing more goalies emulate his style, but, you know, the way Blaze Reardon plays and how he played when he first got in was certainly unorthodox. I mean, Dylan Ward is probably the epitome of that. Like, you know, I think people try to emulate what he does and they just can't do it, but man, is he so different to prep for as a goalie, right? And so, like, when you think of those two, they're some of the best goalies in the league. And, you know, for them to, you know, kind of spearhead other goalies trying different things, it's really been a kind of a renaissance in the position, right? And so you start to see these goalies be a little bit more untraditional. And then you throw in, like, any goalie that's athletic and is coming out and trying to make plays outside of the crease, there's a soft spot in my heart for that too. Okay. And I think we need to be a little bit unorthodox here at Dartmouth. And so it's almost like the goalie should be almost a microcosm of that. Right. And so that's something that we're honing in on for this 25 class.
Amazing. Well, Sean, thanks for coming on, man. I'm so fired up for you. Can't wait to see how you guys do and look forward to checking in and seeing how it's progressing throughout the fall.
Yeah, Jamie, thank you. This is always a blast. I really appreciate you taking interest in this program here at Dartmouth. We're really excited to get going here. And so thank you for the opportunity.